the very first lesson we teach is mindset. You have to get your mindset right. You have to understand who you are, why you're thinking the way you are, what you have in front of you, what you have behind you, and what you're using from behind you that is projecting what you're going to do in front of you.
It's time for you to live a life filled with happiness, blessed with prosperity, empowered by purpose. Here you'll learn the habits and decisions that will elevate your opportunities, add altitude to your attitude, and propel you towards the life of your dreams from successful pilots and entrepreneurs. This is the Plane Success Podcast with Alan Underwood.
According to a recent survey, military veterans are 40% more likely to be the victim of fraud than the civilian population. Military consumers reported monetary losses from fraud over $400 million in 2022. That was a 50% increase from 2021. Adam Labar is here with us today because I know that he's passionate about military veterans, educating and protecting their families. And he has partnered with other veterans to help military families gain financial freedom and to educate them so that they can avoid harmful situations like what the families in this survey experienced. Adam, tell us about active duty, passive income.
Wow, that's an interesting stat that I'm not sure I actually knew. I could totally see it, but I didn't know that was a thing. So, all right, so ADPI, or Active Duty Passive Income, we are an education company and community designed to teach military members, veterans, and their families how to invest in real estate and create financial freedom for them and their families.
And Adam, why did you get involved? What does ADPI look like now? And this is a topic that's near and dear to my heart. My grandfather was a master sergeant in the Air Force. And just a few weeks, my daughter will marry a man who's in the Air Force. And so my job as a dad to protect and provide for them. I mean, this stat hits right at home for me because it very well could impact my family. So tell me, if somebody like my soon-to-be son-in-law and my daughter are wanting to grow in financial independence, what does working with ADPI provide for them?
Yeah. So we provide an education community and platform to be able to learn anything you'd like. In our bread and butter is teaching people how to use their VA loan to actually buy investment properties, right? So you're not technically allowed to buy an investment property. However, when you move every 2 to 3 years, for some people that are blessed and lucky, they stay somewhere for 5 years. But when you move, you have to go get a new house. That means you have to vacate the one you're in. So if you use your VA loan to buy this house and then you move, guess what you can do? You can put a renter inside there and then go and get another house at your next place, right? But if we could get you to buy a duplex, triplex, or quadplex using that VA loan, now you can live in there for free while you're stationed at that assignment too. So like, let's take one of my assignments. I was in North Carolina. Had I bought a triplex there when I was in North Carolina, I could have lived in one of them, rented out the other two, lived rent-free. And then when I moved, I could have put a third person in there. Now I'd have three doors cash flowing for me, and then do that a couple times over my career. I could have a decent portfolio before I retire. So our goal is to kind of build a community around that thought process that we can all learn from each other as we're growing our portfolios. If you want to get really down and dirty and learn apartment buildings, which is pretty much all I've ever invested in, and we have a program to be able to do that as well. If you want to do short-term rentals, we have a program to be able to do that as well to kind of teach you the nuts and bolts of how to get this stuff rolling.
Adam, that's incredible. Why the passion there? How did you get involved in real estate? And when did you make the connection between your military experience and investing in real estate?
So I'll say that I started off, I tell people all the time, like I didn't know what a savings account was until I married my wife. Right, because I was very paycheck to paycheck my entire life. That's what I saw my parents do. That's what I did when I was an enlisted guy, just running through. All of my friends did the same thing. There was no such thing as buying. Like, you could buy a car, but you don't buy a house. That's just not an E4 does in the military. You don't go and buy a house. Well, I would love to change that thought process and say, yes, it's exactly what E4s do in the military, is buy houses, right? But I ended up getting out of the military, got married while I was in college, and my wife had this magical thing called a savings account, and she put money into it. And I was baffled by this concept. So the more I talked to her, she was like, yeah, my parents have a rental house, so we should think about buying real estate. So I laughed at her and then went and said, I'll go lose money in the stock market instead. So that's what I did, is I lost money in the stock market instead. And then I came back with my tail between my legs and my head down, asking my wife what that was about real estate she was talking about. So that's really what got me interested, was my wife. I ended up, my very first investment property was a 62-unit apartment. Right around that same time, I met Markion and Eric, who are co-founders of ADPI. They had just kind of kicked it off and they said, hey, this apartment stuff is cool. And I'd already learned a bunch about it. So I joined the team to kind of help teach the community, which at that time was only like 1,000 people, if probably not even that. Now we've got somewhere around like 78 or 79,000 people in our community. So I just came in to kind of teach people what I'm doing in the multifamily side of the house.
So Adam, there's a lot of questions from that little bit of story that you just introduced. One follow-up is, how important has your wife been in your success? Not only in the beginning, it sounds like she was very influential, but what kind of role is she playing now in the success that you're enjoying?
I think the number one relationship a man can make is the wife he chooses and the wife that chooses him back, right? I think that is by far the most important relationship you could possibly choose, besides the one you have with, for me as a Christian, the one I have with Jesus is the only one that outperforms this one, right? So I think that she has been unbelievably instrumental in all of my successes in life. She's always been supportive of me in all the real estate stuff. When I came back to her and I told her, I said, hey, like, I want to buy an apartment building. And she was like, I'm sorry, you want a what? Like, I was thinking maybe a house. We could start by buying a house maybe. And I said, no, we're going to buy an apartment building. And she was like, if that's what you think is best, let's do it. So she was ready to go. And she's put her full faith in me as the investor to go out and do it. She's still active duty Air Force. So she's not doing much at all with the business side of the house. It's all me. But she just kind of lets me go and does my thing, lets me do my thing. We constantly are in communication about the stuff. She doesn't want to be ignorant to it, but she doesn't necessarily want to be involved in it either. So she gives me that freedom and space to be able to go and take risks and run forth and make it happen. So there's one time I told her, as before we even started investing, the more research I was doing, I said, hey, just so you know, Raquel, like, there's going to be a day I walk up to you and I say, I'm really sorry, honey. I think we just lost $30,000 on this deal. And I said, I want you to get comfortable with that now before I have that conversation with you, because that $30,000 that we lose is going to help us earn $300,000 by being wise, by learning what we need to do, being wiser with our investment. And she took to that just fine, right? It took a second, but she took to it just fine once we had the conversation about it. She's been unbelievably instrumental in making this happen.
Okay, so have you had to cash in on that conversation? Has there been that opportunity to say, oh, we lost some money?
I was super close to making that a multiple six-figure conversation on one deal. I mean, I, by the skin of my teeth, like, the market came up during COVID in a way that we were not expecting, but that's what happens when you pump trillions of dollars into the economy in a fake way. But the economy perked up. We were able to sell an asset. And I think we made 1% on that deal over, I think, the 4 or 5 years we owned it. But I was really close to having a like $200,000 or $300,000 conversation with her, as opposed to a $30,000 conversation with her. So, but no, I have not had to go to that level yet. We have lost some money, thankfully, not a ton. So,
how important to you emotionally and mentally has been knowing that she believes in you and supports you?
I'm going to tell a story to answer a question. I was in the military for about 18 years. I had about 15 and a half active, a couple years of the reserves. So it was around 17 or 18 years total. And I got out of active. So I was active duty, went in the reserves for a little bit after I graduated college, then went back active duty again, and then got out. So I got out to spend more time with my kids and to be able to do this real estate and business stuff full time. I was tired of saying goodbye to my family. I was tired of being all over the world doing all of that stuff with no tangible return for me or my family. There was a deficit, but no return at all. And I just had a conversation with her. I said, hey, I think I need to get out. And that's a pretty hefty paycheck by that point. Decently over six figures, really good benefits, all the stuff that goes along with being in the military. And I couldn't keep doing it. I said, I really need to jump ship. I can't keep doing this anymore. I've lost my passion for what I'm doing. I really want to be a dad. I really want to run these businesses. And the amount of money that I'll make doing all of that is going to far outweigh what I'm doing here. It took maybe three of those conversations with her before she was like, nah, totally get it. We've got it. Go for it. Like, absolutely go out and crush it. And even last week, I come back from the gym and I walk into the bedroom and there's a note written on there. I'm so proud of you, Adam, for everything you're doing. I love you so much. Thank you for doing what you're doing for our family. All of this stuff written on my mirror for when I returned. So that has continued through the years of her being completely supportive. And if it wasn't for that, then I think I would be in a completely different scenario. My mindset would not be where it needs to be. My emotions would certainly not be where it needs to be. But she gives me that freedom to be able to run and do it, even though sometimes it's real tough. We haven't bought an apartment building in like a year and a half because the market's been really crappy. It's been tough to find something that cash flows, but she's still supportive. She's like, hey, you keep doing you. I know that you're doing what you need to take care of the family. So that's unbelievably important for me.
That's amazing, Adam. How do you show her similar support? What does that look like the other direction?
Right now, she's in a position that is very time consuming, especially right now as we're recording this. She's been, I think last week, she was putting in no less than 12 hours a day in the office, sometimes up to 16 hours in days, just hammering it out. And I'll give her a call at 6:30 in the evening, say, hey, just checking on you to see where you're at. And I tell her right from the beginning, like, this is not a call to say, why are you not home for dinner? This is a call to just say, hey, I'm here to support you, whatever you need. If you need to stay there for another 3 hours and stay there for another 3 hours, I'm here with the kids. I've got everything taken care of. And she knows that, and she trusts that's what's going on at home. And when she needs some time away, I encourage her to take that time away. She went on a cruise recently with all the ladies to celebrate my niece's 21st birthday. That was good. And she twice told me she was going to cancel the cruise. I said, you absolutely are not. You need to go, and I will take care of the kids. So don't sweat it. Go and enjoy some time off. So we are extremely supportive of each other and making sure that we both have each other's back. She lets me go on all sorts of GoPundits trips and go hang out with guys like you for a while. So the least I could do is let her go on a cruise with my family, right? So,
Adam, that's amazing. I want to bounce back from not knowing what a savings account was, and then your first deal is a 62-unit apartment complex. Most people would think that was crazy. Did she think that was crazy initially? And I'd love to know what the chatter was of family and friends around you, because oftentimes the people that are closest to us are often the least supportive of these visions and dreams that we have. So I'd love to know the environment of that decision and what was going on in your head as you made that. What was your level of confidence in the success of that venture?
So, boy, my level of confidence in the success of that venture. I would say at the beginning, I had a false sense of security about what I was getting into. So let me preface. I started off with about 4 years of educating myself, which is how I finally got to the point where I said, I think apartment buildings is where we need to be. And then I did a lot of analysis paralysis. I sat around trying to figure out, okay, well, I just need this one more conference, or I just need this one more podcast, or I just need this one more whatever. Insert education path here. Because it was a little nerve-wracking to say, hey, this is what I think I really need to go buy an apartment building. But I kept having conversations with my wife. She knew what I was learning about, and I was explaining a bunch of stuff to her. And then when I finally said, hey, I think we're going to buy apartment buildings, and then that was an interesting conversation for sure. And I said, I think what I need to do, though, is I need to, because again, analysis paralysis, I need to join this community. So I joined community with Jake and Gino, Wheelbarrow Profits folks. And within 6 months of being in that community, was under contract on the 62-unit apartment. So to me, that was like that extra step of, okay, I'm around all these like-minded people. I'm engaged with them. We are all on the same page. We're all trying to do something better for ourselves. You know, and it's that famous, you are the five people you hang around most. I think it's Sam Zell that said that. So I surrounded myself with people who were buying apartment buildings. And what do you know? I bought an apartment building, right? So that conversation with my wife was a little uncomfortable because, like, okay, what is this going to cost? Like, that's so much different than a house. Like, who actually buys apartment buildings? That doesn't make sense. And so it was like, no, we buy apartment buildings. I don't know if you know this, but we're getting ready to buy an apartment building. And now we actually are ones who buy apartment buildings. So that conversation was interesting for sure. And to go to the other question you had is, what did the people around me think? Everybody thought I was a little crazy, of course. But I didn't talk real estate with any of my military friends because as far as I knew, none of the military folks were interested in this at all. So none of them were there to tell me how crazy I was. But I did talk to my mom about it. And I was like, hey, I'm going to buy apartment buildings. And then she just laughed at me. And I told her, I said straight up, I said, Mom, I will never share this type of stuff with you again if you're going to laugh at me. It's because that's not going to help me succeed in what I'm doing. I said, you're still going to be my mom and I'm still going to love you, but I'm not going to share these types of things with you if that's the reaction. And she immediately was like, you are absolutely right. I'm so sorry. I have every confidence that you're going to be able to do it. So I'm looking forward to it. And what do you know? I go and now I've had, I don't know, somewhere around 400 doors or so of apartment buildings. And it's been a fun time going through all of that. So at first, no, it wasn't all support all the time. There was a little bit of tension here and there, but I was very adamant that this is what I was going to be doing, and I was pushing forward on it.
I love that in the moment you had that conversation with your mom, you must have had a good relationship. Number one, that you were willing to share what your dream was, what you're doing, but also that then when the response wasn't what you needed, that you were able to articulate that. I remember my first business venture, I was 21, 22 years old. And I, after 6 months of working in a Subway restaurant, decided that I was qualified enough to go and open my own restaurant.
Of course.
It didn't even occur to me that it might not work until I spoke with my grandfather and shared with him my idea. I didn't know at the time that I was probably pitching him the idea, but I was sharing my excitement for it. And his response to that was, Alan, that will never work.
Mm-hmm.
And I found that at key points in my life where I'm making these big decisions, leveling up, if you will, that there's always been at least one person that said, that will never work. You're making the worst decision of your life. Why can't you just be normal? And I love the fact that you could have that conversation with your mom in the moment. And that introduces another thing that I know that you're really passionate about, and that's about being a parent, especially being a dad. Tell me, what is the genesis of that passion for you? And how is that playing out in your life right now?
What's the genesis? I don't really know. I've wanted to be a dad since I was like 13 years old. So as odd as that sounds, I've always wanted to be a dad. So like getting married, I knew like, okay, well, this is what I need to do, right? And to me, my dad wasn't the most present father in the world, and not necessarily by anything of his own fault or anything. He was not the most present father. He had a lot of work to do. And it was just, it seems that most people I talk to that around our age, that's just like that age of dads, just they weren't always around that much, right? So they were focused on making sure that there was food on the table, making sure there was a house over the head, and that's about it, right? And he was very focused on making sure that I did not have a childhood that he had. And he was extremely successful in making sure that I did not have a childhood anywhere like he had.
What was that childhood that he was protecting you from?
So his real dad died when he was like 2 years old, and his stepdad was very abusive, especially to him. My dad was the second youngest of nine, but the youngest of his dad's children, his real dad's children. And then there was one more that came with his stepfather, which of course was the golden child type of thing, right? And so my dad took a lot of the abuse, and he ended up getting as many jobs as he could when he was in the house to be able to be out of the house. He joined the military right out of high school to get the heck away from it. A lot of his family ended up in jail or some sort of legal trouble here or there. And my dad ended up kind of freeing himself from all that by joining the military. So as I get older, the more I understand about my dad and the more I know what he went through, which I'll leave some of the complete horror stories out of it. But the more I understand what he went through, the more I understood that he never even had the ability to give me some of the things I felt like I was missing. Cause like that was like a piece that was missing from him that he wasn't able to share with me. Like he never had an emotional connection with a father or a father figure. Like there was nothing there. So for him, really, it was like, this is not to sound bad, but it was almost transactional. Okay, do they have food? Do they have a roof over the head? Do they have clothes? Done. I've done my job. And I can't blame him for that thought process, right? And are they not being abused, right? So like that's a success for him. And to this day, I'm super excited and thrilled that was something he was able to provide to us. To me and my two sisters. So that was the experience that he didn't want us to be exposed to at all. And I had a small taste of it, very, very small taste of it. I was probably 8 years old, and I used to always pat him. I used to call him grandpa at the time. I haven't really since. It's just Howard. Well, he's since passed, but I would pat him on the head and say, see you later, grandpa. And I'd leave. And I would do this every time. No issues, no problems. One time I patted him on the head. I said, see you later, grandpa. And he said, you touch my head again, I'll break your arm. And there was no jokes about it. There was no nothing. He was very serious. If I touched his head again, he was going to break my arm. And I looked at my dad, and he's like, that's it. We're not coming back. And we never went back. Like, we didn't go back to grandma and grandpa's house. We saw grandpa after that. But like, my dad knew, like, this is the type of stuff he would do. And it's not like, this is not abnormal for Howard. Like, this is what he does. And I was like, all right, well, there goes that. But I wasn't old enough to really understand what was going on, but I was old enough to know that something wasn't right, you know? So to go back to the original question of my passion for being a dad, I want to pour into my kids as much as humanly possible. I want them to, just like my dad was able to set the stage for me to become a successful man, I want to set the stage for my kids to be unbelievably successful. And when I talk to my boys, and now it's a little bit different with my daughter, but hey, she's only 10 months old. She's not understanding what I'm saying anyways. But when I talk to my boys, they know that my goal in life is to make them better men than me. So if I can pour into them the way I need to, start businesses with them. Right now, I'm homeschooling them, which I truly enjoy doing. Bring them on as many travels as I can with them. Let them know all the time that I'm here, that I'm like, they're safe, they're protected. They have got anything that they need, but they also are strong enough to tackle the world in front of them, climb the biggest trees they could think of, climb mountains, go do all the stuff that they want to be able to do. Indoor skydiving like we did this past weekend, right? They could do anything in the world that they want, and we're going to help them make that happen. That's my goal. And as my daughter grows up, it's my goal is to represent a man that is treating his spouse correctly, is treating his wife correctly, taking care of his kids correctly, so that she knows what to be looking out for in a man when she grows up as well. So I don't know if I fully answered your question, but I think I danced around it enough. So,
no, I think, and just to be very candid, to think of what your dad provided for you, that makes me emotional. He was a hero in his own right. He stopped a chain of abuse, and it's incredibly difficult to create a new pattern.
Oh, yeah.
I think it's amazing what you're doing. The same intentionality that your dad had took his family to a new level, and now you're doing that in your own way. And I think that's so critical for people to see that regardless of the circumstances that you came from, regardless of what your past looks like, it doesn't determine your future at all. You can choose to be whatever you want to be. And I think that's so important. And I'm just trying to like visualize what that will mean for your kids and for their families in the future. What will the next level be for them, because they didn't have a dad or grandpa that was abusive. Mm-hmm. They did have a dad who was emotionally connected and involved with them and who was supporting their dreams and their vision. So what kind of gifts are they going to be able to give their kids, your grandkids someday?
Yeah.
And what a powerful legacy that your dad started creating with just a decision. You know, you're right. He couldn't be an emotionally connected dad. He didn't know what that looked like, but he knew what he didn't want. And I think sometimes when people get stuck in what am I going to do? Who am I going to be? Maybe the first place is decide what you don't want to be and just start there and then move forward. What are your thoughts on that, on making personal changes like that? What are some maybe some challenges that you've faced in creating that vision for your family or making changes that were different than what you experienced as a kid?
So I think that there's one, again, all I ever saw was, so there's two different things. You mentioned like my dad changed a legacy, right? It changed the way it goes, right? I don't know if everybody has seen it, but to me, I've seen it a billion times at this point, at least replayed in my brain. That picture of there's a child being abused by the dad. It's like a shadowy type of picture. And then it goes around and then that kid grows up and ends up abusing his kid. And then it goes around. It just keeps going in a circle, just like you were talking about, right? Where the abuser becomes, or the abused becomes the abuser, or the abused becomes an abuser. And it just keeps going in that cycle until somebody breaks that down. And that is what I often say in that scenario. But our life, we're going to go down paths one way or another that are usually played out when we were younger. So we've seen this as a pattern as we were growing up. For me, I talk about this a lot with finances, is I saw my parents spend their money every 2 weeks and then get another paycheck, spend their money every 2 weeks, get another paycheck. I joined the military. I saw them get their paycheck. And every other week, you just spend all your money. So I had this wireframe in my brain of what it means to spend your money. Like, this is just what happens. And then when I got married, that was a massive change, like a huge wipe of my wireframe. And that's what we need in our lives, is somebody to come and wipe the wireframe, like break it all down, rebuild something else in its place. So my dad was able to rebuild his past to turn into my now future. And my wife was able to help me break down my past to now build what is now my future as I'm growing all of this stuff out. So I think that we all have to be able to go through these transitions in life and these changes on what we're doing to help fix it. But we need somebody to step in and help us with those sometimes, because we don't know that we're just doing the same thing over and over again, because that's just what we do. Like, we didn't know that this was a model that was sent to us over and over again. It was like, it's just, again, if it's just your habit, you don't realize you're doing something until somebody comes in and says, do you realize what you're doing? Do you realize like how you're showing up right now, that you're just doing the same thing you've always seen, or the same thing that's always been done that way? So you're not changing it. So somebody needs to come in and help you change your wireframe. Maybe it's getting into a car accident when you are drunk, and that's what breaks your wireframe, right? And you realize, holy crap, I've been spending all of these hours just getting drunk all the time. And I did, like, it took this split second of a mistake to get into a car accident, for something terrible to happen, for me to now realize that I need to readjust what I'm doing. And then you could change your entire life from those moments. You don't need something as drastic as getting into a car accident when you're drunk, but something has to come in and change that wireframe, change that thought process. So I think it's extremely important to keep tabs of those, have people in your life that you can have those conversations with, like, hey, what am I doing? Where am I making mistakes in my life? What are you seeing? Take ownership of the fact that you own your life and that you can adjust what you're doing by having those questions and working to get past them.
Adam Labar is changing the lives of active duty and retired military families by educating them on the power of multifamily real estate investing and financial freedom. Angel Flight West provides free flights for active duty and retired military personnel. We also provide free flights for people in need of medical care far from home. If you or a family member has a need that seems overwhelming to overcome financially, you probably need to talk to Adam. If there's a medical need or an urgent situation where you need help getting transportation, please look up Angel Flight West, www.angelflightwest.org, and let one of our volunteer pilots be a blessing for your family. Is that what your experience has been with active duty, passive income? Is that what you're trying to do, is shift that mindset with people that come looking for that help? Is that the most difficult challenge, is just disconnecting, hey, this is how you've been doing things.
Yeah.
Let me show you how you can do things in the future. So that's question one. And the next one is, how are you doing that for yourself now? Obviously, you've had that mind shift, and now you've gone from they buy apartments to we buy apartments. Mm-hmm. What is the next big thing that's requiring you to make another mind shift.
Yeah. So let's start with the first question, ADPI. So yes, I think that mindset is by far the, like, even when my partner Tim and I built the Multifamily Academy, that is the very first lesson we teach is mindset. Like, you have to get your mindset right. You have to understand who you are, why you're thinking the way you are, what is what you have in front of you, what you have behind you, and what you're using from behind you that is projecting what you're going to do in front of you. And that's not necessarily a good thing. So that is by far the biggest issue, I think, is getting over that. And like, my wife and I were just having a conversation last night. She sat down with a 3-star general that was getting ready to leave, and he sat down and said, don't. We started this conversation with a mass amount of veterans who commit suicide. We have 22 veterans a day that commit suicide, probably a little bit higher than that right now, but that was the most recent stat that's actually been thrown around forever. So 22 veterans a day committing suicide. And my wife and I were trying to, I was explaining to my wife my theory on why that is, or some of my ideas that I think are beyond theories at this point, is we get thrown into the military and our identity is, I am an airman, I am a Marine, I'm a SEAL, I am a insert branch of the military here, insert whatever it is of the military here. And that's where we end up tying our identity. And when your identity is tied to something that can be lost pretty quickly, even if it's after 20 years, it's still quickly, because the retirement happens and the next day you're not wearing a uniform anymore. So if you take your uniform off and at that same time you're throwing your identity in the laundry hamper as well, like, what does that do to a psyche, right? If your whole identity has been wearing this uniform for your entire adult life and that's all you've known, and then all of a sudden you take it off and throw it in the hamper, like, that turns into a massive problem, right? So when we're talking to people, especially veterans, and you look at it as well, like, if you do stuff like I did in Afghanistan or Iraq, where you're like, you're building op plans, I'm getting ready to go take down a house, or you're getting ready to go do a heavy mission, you're going out on a 3-day camping trip in the middle of the mountains of Afghanistan for whatever reason, right? You're setting up all these ops, you know what your mission is, you know what your objective is. You don't know what's going to happen while you're on the mission, but you at least know where you're going, right? And then you get out of the military, nobody's setting an objective for you, nobody's setting missions for you, it's all you now. So not only is your identity now gone, I'm no longer an airman, I'm no longer Marine, I'm no longer a whatever, but now I don't even know what my objective is in life. I don't have a target anymore. So that is going to cause a lot of consternation inside of a military member's brain as they're trying to figure this out. So to go back to the 3-star general that my wife was talking to. So the general was like, look, don't stay in the military just because of this uniform you're wearing. Stay in because, like, you're trying to make a difference. Stay in because you want to do X, Y, or Z. Like, have a purpose, a reason behind it. Don't just do whatever because of the uniform and you don't know that you have anything else to do. And that was a huge, like, she mentioned that after I had the conversation with her about military members and the suicide problems with, you know, their identity. So, and that's something I actually was talking about just recently. You and I were at a GoBundance event. I was talking to that with somebody, like, wanting to have some of these conversations with my wife so that when she takes that uniform off for the last time, there's not an identity problem either, because I know that that is a huge problem. So when we're at ADPI, we're trying to show that, like, hey, your new objective is a different why. Like, your why before was to support the military. Your why before was something else. But now you have a new objective, right? Maybe your objective is to create financial freedom for your entire family. Maybe your new objective is to buy X amount of apartment buildings, or we don't usually like to say buy X amount of apartment buildings, because once you hit that, is your objective over? No, like, you have to have a deeper why than just a dollar amount or, you know, a number amount of doors or whatever it is. For me, my kids are, my family is by far my why. Like, they are why I do all of this. So that is something that we really tie into inside of ADPI, is find a new, like, really nail in what your why is. And once you think that's your why, ask yourself why again. Why is that my why? Is that truly where it's at, or do I need to go another layer deeper? So part two of your question was what I'm changing in now, like, what kind of ways I'm changing now. Boy, that's been a struggle for me for a little while, because, like, when I first left the military, or when I second left the military, right, I left specifically to run business and buy apartment buildings. I was not expecting to take over COO of ADPI. We had some leadership changes, things that were going on. I took that over and stopped buying apartment buildings. Not perfect timing, because the market was really sucking too. So it was tough to buy anything that cash flowed, but it took up a lot of my mental space. And now I'm still kind of getting stuck going, okay, am I still an apartment investor? Like, I haven't bought anything in like a year and a half. Is that still something I do? Like, what's going on? But I know that the classic, the things that got you here, the things that got you to your first million aren't going to get you to 10 million. Things that get you to 10 million aren't going to get you to 100 million. So you've got to be able to strip some of that stuff. And I had realized that I've been really stuck in my own brain of saying, hey, like, you've got more than you ever thought you were going to. You've got more than your family ever had. Like, you can put it in coast. And that's wrong. Like, I can't put it in coast mode. Like, this is not going to be where I need to be, nor is what I have now going to last me the rest of my life. So I need to make sure that I'm really pushing hard. So I've stripped a lot of some of the bad mindsets that I've had. Had a good conversations with folks inside my GoPod, inside my family, to really help me push to the next level. So what it looks like for me is really stepping up to letting go some of my previous bad thoughts and bad habits. I've completely revamped my calendar. I've completely revamped the way I work my day, changed how I want to project myself going forward. inside my company and outside, because it's something that constantly needs to be redone, is change that wireframe. Like, it was great. I'm glad it got me to where I was at with a few hundred doors, 400 doors. Now it's time to move on to the next step.
I love that. I think changing identity can be one of the most difficult challenges that any one of us face. I think it's easier when we're deciding that it's time to change that identity. Mm-hmm. It's still difficult because, and this is an experience I'm having now, looking at the goals, the dreams that I have, my vision board, that's just, I'm looking at it right now. I still look at that every morning and go, I don't even know how that's going to be possible. Mm-hmm. I don't know what it's going to require, what the sacrifices are going to be. And then I break it down into, okay, well, if that's going to happen in 3 years, what has to happen in one? That's going to happen in 1 year. What has to happen this month? And if it's going to happen this month, what has to happen today? And for me, that's the only way that I can realize any of that stuff. And the first part is you have to believe that it's possible for you. And if I'm just talking in my own head, that it's possible for Alan Underwood to do that. That's what successful people do. And then to change my own mind to identify with being the type of person that can do that. Like, walk with my wife this morning, she was sharing something that she's been learning, where first we think, then we do, and then we become. And I can see that in what you're saying. You had this 4-year education period, and then you just started doing the thing, right? You did it really big with the first one. And then all of a sudden you became an apartment investor, but now you're at that level. And so what is that next level look like? And I can hear you starting to make that mental shift. What are some of the things that you need to do in order to become that next version of Adam Labar? What are some of the daily tasks, the habits, the routines, the things that you feel will propel you to that next level?
So funny, because you kind of laid out some of what that is for me right now, is right sitting down and creating that 3-year vision with my wife on where we're going to be. That 1-year plan of what we're going to be doing. I'm an EOS guy for my business, so it's kind of the way my brain works, is in a lot of EOS stuff right now. But our 3-year vision of where we want to be, like, sit down and truly do what a vivid vision looks like for our family. What is that going to be in 3 years? What's that going to be in 5 years? Break that down to 1 year. And I've created some different goals. This is the first time my wife and I have sat down for 2024 and sat down together and did family goals. What we want to do every quarter, how we want to work these things out, what kind of adventures we want to be on, all the stuff written down so we know where we're going. So that's going to help drive me towards, now I can break that down and say, okay, well, if that's what I want to do this year, the only way to do that is to break my calendar down and say, I need this many hours of underwriting. I need this many hours of calling brokers. I need this many hours of insert task here. And I even hired somebody to help me break out my calendar. Like, where am I wasting my time? What am I doing that I shouldn't be doing? Where's my transactional versus transformational stuff? Like, if I can get rid of my transactional stuff and hand it over to my assistant so that I can focus on the transformational stuff that helps grow the business and the family, that's where I need to be focused. So that's what I've been doing. Before, I was like, it was all me, whatever I could do, just run with my hair on fire. And now it's like, no, I need to be a lot more dedicated and focused in what my actual goals are. Otherwise, I'll just be running around in circles. So that's what the new me is working on doing, is having all of that in place to know that if I build the system, I'll get to where I want to be. That's where I'm at now, systematizing things.
So it sounds like it's not just inserting things, but it's also extracting. Right? It's leaving things behind that no longer serve you. And I love the intentionality there. You and I are both pilots. We share that passion. And a lot of flying is very intentional. However, sometimes there are accidental experiences in flying. You shared, and I don't know the story, but you shared a little bit of a teaser with me about an accidental flight that you had into some clouds at night.
Oh, yeah.
I'd love to know what the intention of that flight was, and then how did you accidentally end up in the clouds at night, and what was that experience?
Yeah, the intention of the flight was literally just night currency. Just get my 3 takeoffs and landings, get comfortable again. If you don't fly at night very often, that runway looks a lot different when you're coming in for a landing at night than it does in the middle of the day. It sneaks up on you a lot faster. You're going down at the same speed, but for some reason, boy, that runway catches up to you real quickly, right? So I'm just out there, you know, doing some touch and goes, having a good time. And they warned me when I first rented, hey, there's clouds out at TPA, out of Tampa. They're moving this direction, but you should be fine. I said, okay, no problem. So I'm doing my touch. He goes, I'm on my third one. And you could see the clouds on my second one. I was like, they're out there. No big deal. So I come around and there's somebody from Lakeland coming in. And he calls it on the radio. It's like, yeah, you know, the clouds are moving in pretty quickly. Just be aware of that. And he's like, okay, we see your spot from here. No problem. I don't foresee being an issue. So, okay. So I go and I taxi over to the runway and I take off. And almost like before I even get ready to take my left turn, I've got a cloud in my face. And by in my face, I don't mean, oh, I see it out there. I mean, it's in my windshield. And I was like, oh no, like these clouds came here unbelievably fast. Like there was no warning for it at all. And I've got somebody else who was doing the same thing, doing currency, getting ready to take the runway and follow me out. And I jump on the radio real quick. I was like, hey, do not, like, don't do what I just did. Stay on the ground. I'm just letting you know, I'm at like 700 feet and I just ran into a cloud in my face. And thankfully, I was very close, obviously, to the runway. So that's good. But the number one cause of accidents is flying non-IFR into IFR conditions, accidental flying into IFR conditions, so instrument conditions. And then running into terrain or getting lost and doing like the death spiral down to the ground or whatever it is, you lose an idea of where you're at because you can't see what's going on. So thankfully, I've been working on my instrument rating. I'm not actually in a ton of danger. I know where things are at. I'm moderately comfortable. I've been through stressful situations, but I kind of go and I just make a much tighter turn to make sure that I can see the lights on the runway and know where I'm at, as opposed to not knowing what cloud I'm getting ready to turn into. And that's the number one rule. If you accidentally end up in clouds, do a 180 degree to turn and get out of there. So I did my quick 180 degree turn. I did a little bit more climbing because that's not a very safe thing to do when you're that low. But I turn around, I end up seeing the runway. My whole everything is all jacked up. I'm too close to the runway by this point. I'm going too fast because I was focusing more on getting out of the clouds than I was at, you know, the fact that I had leveled off at my 2600 RPM and I'm flying now. I'm like cruising too fast. So I settle everything back in. I do a really long downwind, settle myself down a minute, and thankfully the guy on the ground made the call to not take off. He was already rolling. He was like, no, I think we got it, and just started rolling. And then you could hear him shut it down or see him shut it down. And then he turned off the runway instead of taking off. But I got myself around, get myself in, I land. Take a deep breath and go, okay, you know, because I told him, like, what if this landing doesn't go well? Now what do I do? Like, if I've got to do a go around for whatever reason, I mean, a deer comes running across, like, I've got to do a go around and I'm going to do a go around into clouds. So I'm like, what in the world am I supposed to do here? But thankfully, none of that happened. The routine, just doing a few touch and goes, turned into a little bit more of an exciting situation than I intended it to. That's for sure.
At the time, were you instrument rated? Were you prepared for flight into weather, or... were you not
just not instrument rated, just instrument training, right? About maybe 15 hours into my instrument flying, the true instrument flying. But no, definitely not instrument rated. I was not intending or wanting or even thinking that that was going to be an exciting part of my flight that day.
Was there ever a point in that flight where you weren't sure of what the outcome was going to be? You take off, you hit the cloud, and it's like, oh my gosh, now I'm in this situation that I hadn't mentally prepared myself for. Now what?
Honestly, I was very focused on what I needed to do, and that was it. So, like, it's funny. We had a good speaker chatting about anxiety, Adam Hill, at the Florida event that we were just at. And a lot of times, anxiety comes from what, like, you're thinking about what is going to happen in the future that may not actually happen in the future, because the future hasn't happened yet. So, like, who knows what's actually going to happen? I would think that my experience in the military, especially in combat zones, has really kind of helped mold that fact in my brain that I don't know what is coming around the corner, and it doesn't matter. Because whatever it is, I trained for this, so I can go ahead and do it. And I knew what I needed to do. This is just the first time I'd had to do it in this particular scenario. I had never accidentally flown into clouds before, so this was new to me. So I wouldn't say that I was unsure of what was going to happen. I would say that I was planning for what may or may not happen. But, you know, it was like, okay, well, eventually I'm going to be out of this cloud without an issue. Eventually, I'm going to figure out where I need to go. And worst case scenario, I'm just flying to a different airport. Like, I already had ideas of what I was going to do while I was on downwind. So going into that cloud, though, like immediately you could feel that the anxiety picked up. I could feel it in my chest. I could feel it in my throat. And I just had to tell myself, military pilots especially, or if you talk to a lot of the older pilots, they'll tell you the first thing you do when an emergency happens is you wind your clock. So something bad happens, you wind your clock in the cockpit, right? And that's not because your clock needs to be wound. It's because you need your brain to take over some tactile thing that needs to happen right now to separate yourself from the emergency. So you wind your clock. Okay, a way to reset yourself, get into the scenario that you need to be in and move on. While I did not wind my clock, I did take my second to go, okay, well, I already know this is the turn that I need to make regardless. So I'm going to make this turn and move over. And then I'm going to assess from there. And then when I get to that point, I'm going to assess from there. And then from that point, I'm going to assess from there. So every step is just a new assessment of where we're, are we on the right track or not, to make sure that I get down on the ground safely and go back to my kiddos and my wife.
And that is the ultimate mission with every flight, right? I think you're probably a lot like me in the fact where I know that every time I get in the plane, there's a possibility that something could go wrong. 99.9% of the time, you're not going to face that possibility. But there is that 1% of the time, or that 0.1% of the time, where something unexpected will come up. whether that's a mechanical issue, it could be a weather issue, you just don't know. And I love how you walked through that mental approach of slowing yourself down. On my instrument check ride, I can remember the pilot examiner, you know, doing pilot examiner things, you know, pulling the throttle out or pulling out the mixture or whatever, and asking the question, if this happens, what are you going to do? And, you know, I was a student pilot, so I was pretty well versed in what the steps were. And he said, no, actually, you're not going to do any of that stuff. The first thing that you're going to do, and I always want you to remember this, is you're going to fly the airplane. The airplane is designed to fly, and as long as you fly the airplane, you'll be able to figure out a way. Mm-hmm. And then you can go through that other stuff. But the first thing you need to do is take a deep breath and remember that you're flying an airplane. And I think there's so many parallels between aviation and life that I have learned just in the last few years that I've been flying. What are some of the key life lessons that you've learned from sitting in the cockpit and either learning to fly or flying a plane?
You're far more capable than you think you are. Other people may tell you you're capable and it doesn't click in your head. The first time I did my solo, I didn't know I was getting ready to do a solo. We just landed. He said, hey, can you pull over here for a second? And he said, all right, I'm getting out. Go do 3 takeoffs and landings. I'm going to watch you. And I said, no, I don't think you understand this. I'm just new to this. I just want you to know that. That was what was going on in my head.
In case you weren't aware,
yeah,
I haven't done that before.
This, just in case you were wondering. I said all that on the inside, but on the outside, I said, you're darn right, I got this. Get out of my plane. So I mean, he jumped out of the plane, with my logbook, started filling everything out, and I'm doing my takeoffs and landings and going through. And I think that's kind of the power of having a mentor beside you. In this case, it's an instructor. They have to be there, right? A mentor doesn't have to be there, but it's having that person next to you that has that confidence in you, that knows that you're ready to go do the next step, that says, dude, like, what are you doing? Go and do it. Like, go forth and do it. Like, you got to get out of here. And I'd say for me also the resilience factor, like it took me a long time to get my pilot's license, like a long time, because I was supposed to be a pilot in the Air Force, but I busted my neck and lost my pilot spot the day before pilot training. They told me, sorry, dude, like your neck's too injured to pull G's, so we can't send you to pilot training. So there went that. So I was like, all right, well, I was going to do this, but now I'm not. And I had only had maybe 4 flight hours at that point, if that, because like I got accepted to be a pilot because I scored well on all the tests. I had a good enlisted career, so that it worked out well for my paperwork for the officer side. So, you know, I should probably go fly a plane to make sure I like this because I've never flown a plane before. Like, I don't like, let's go see. So I went and got a couple lessons just to see what I thought. And I did. I liked it. Hence, I kept going. But then, you know, I lose my pilot spot. I go and start living in Georgia. My wife and I are stationed at 2 different places. I'm working on some hours, and then somehow she got pregnant. So they're like, now I've got to worry about a kid coming into my life. So then the kid comes in, and then I get deployed to Africa, and then we come back, and then we get stationed in Japan. And like, it's just all this stuff just keeps on going. And thank God there was a spot in Japan. We had an aero club on base where I was able to fly. So that's where I finally finished all of my training. And then the guy for my check ride ends up getting a really bad medical diagnosis and loses all of his ability to fly. So that my check ride examiner can't come out to Japan anymore to do the check ride. So now I got to figure out how I'm going to do a check ride. So I set it all up when I get into Florida. We're going home on leave. So we go back to Florida. I make some phone calls. I get a plane to be able to rent, get checked out with their plane, and then go do my check ride with this random check ride examiner that I found. So nothing in your life is going to go the way you plan, and nothing in flying is likely to go the way you plan. One way or another, something's going to go wrong, whether it's maybe they don't have fuel at the airport you wanted to, or maybe that you aren't able to get the full amount of fuel that you wanted to, or maybe you know, whatever it is. Hopefully all your flights go well, but it doesn't mean they're all going to go to plan. So, you know, it's that famous saying of everyone's got a plan until you get punched in the face that Mike Tyson said. And the way that we say in the military is planes go in the garbage at first contact, right? Like the first time you come in contact with the enemy, your plane goes in the garbage. So have a plan, know what it is, but just accept the fact that things are going to change. You know, you're going to have that alternate on that IFR flight because the minimums are too low. So you got to go somewhere else. But you weren't expecting that. The clouds came in too fast. You're going to fly into that cloud by accident because that's just the way life goes. My plan wasn't for that, but I knew how to get out of it if I needed to. So I think resilience and knowing that, like, just building those plans has been very important for me in kind of relating flying and life in general.
I love those lessons that you learned. And I will push back a little bit. You said that nothing is going to go right. And where I would challenge that is I think I used to feel that way until you zoom out and you recognize that these situations that are difficult are different than what you imagined, usually lead you to exactly where you need to be in the best place that you're supposed to be. I love that you said you were supposed to be a pilot, and you are. You've accomplished that. But I have to imagine that at the time receiving that news in the Air Force had to have felt devastating. Like, here you've built your dreams, your life up to this point. You're probably imagining yourself playing volleyball on the beach with Tom Cruise and the other fighter pilots. And all of a sudden that ends. But I wonder, where do you think that life would have taken you compared to the life that you were given? And it's hard to see that in the moment. We get punched in the face. We fly into clouds, something happens, and all of a sudden there's this panic attack because the life that you're living doesn't match the vision that you wrote on the board. Mm-hmm. And I went through that recently where it felt like everything that I was trying to do was a complete failure. Like, I would say, oh, this is the thing that's going to get me where I want to go. And I would do it, put all my energy, it felt right, I was praying about it. And then within a few months, it wouldn't work out. And that seemed to happen over and over and over again. And it was extremely frustrating. And it wasn't really until just a few months ago, maybe about 6 months ago, in a quiet moment when I was sitting reflecting on those experiences, that it's kind of like one of those connect the dot puzzles where All of a sudden I could see the lines connecting the dots. And I recognized that had any one of those things worked out the way that I wanted it to, I would never have the opportunities that I'm having right now. And every single one of those failures had given me an experience or a contact or knowledge that was invaluable to where my life is right now. And so for anyone that's having the experience right now of maybe accidentally flying into a cloud or breaking their neck when they're planning on being a fighter pilot, I hope that the conversation that we're having provides a little bit of perspective and hope that that's going to feel painful right now. That's natural. It's going to feel disappointing. It's going to feel painful. Maybe you feel like a failure. But the reality is that's not going to be true in just a short amount of time. That short amount of time might be days or weeks. It could be years. But at some point, that difficult experience will become the propulsion that takes you to the next level of your life. And I can see that in the story that you're sharing. I'm really grateful that you're doing that. I want to wrap things up with something that my dad, for my entire life, would say, Alan, remember the little things. And I think probably I wondered what those little things were for a long time that I was supposed to be remembering. I think I have a better idea of that now. If you're passing on the little things to your kids, what are some of the little things, the critical things that you think will make the biggest difference in their life that you're trying or working hard to pass on to them?
Boy, that could be a podcast in and of itself, I think. Honestly, I think some of the little things are, I literally tell my boys I love them to the point where they say, I know, Dad, you love me. Like, it's like, but I want you to know that no matter what, I love you. I don't care if you fail me miserably, if I fail you miserably, no matter what it is, I'm always there. I'm always supporting you. That's one of the little things, is telling my kids I love them as much as humanly possible, tucking them in at night. Every opportunity I have to be able to be there by their bedside, to be able to tuck them in and say goodnight and I love you. Even if I have to do it for some odd reason from a Zoom call, I want to be able to say, hey, I love you very much. I hope you have a wonderful night. I'll see you in the morning, or I'll see you in one of the things we used to say all the time when I was in the military was, I'll see you in X amount of sleeps, right? So if I'm going to be gone for five sleeps, I'll see you in five sleeps. So they can't count the days, but they can count the sleeps, right? But just knowing that, letting them know that I'm always there. And honestly, like, always going to church and showing that's something that we do as a family, is we're always at church and saying we're sorry when we screw something up and praising somebody when they do something great. Those are all little things that have a long lasting meaning, right? It doesn't matter if I build a $100 million company and I can pass my kids $33 million a piece. That doesn't mean anything. Sure, that's nice. Everybody wants that. But if all I do is give my kids $33 million, but I've never had a relationship with them, then that doesn't mean anything. It sounds like a big thing, but that's nothing compared to the actual relationship to be able to give. My dad didn't have that money to give, but he created the ability for me to now work on our legacy to go even farther and farther and farther. So those little things are what make sure that I have the connection with my kiddos. So those are some of just the minor little things, you know, kissing them on their head, giving them a hug every time I have a chance to. When I'm going out to work on the truck and I really feel like I have the time to have them help me work on the truck, just bringing them out anyways and say, you know what, this is going to take me a little longer. It's going to be a little bit more of a pain in the butt, but you get to work next to Dad and turn some tools. So let's do it together. Yeah, I'd say those are some of the little things I really try to work on with the kids.
Adam, I love you and I'm so grateful for the time that we've had to spend together. Thank you for sharing your wisdom, your experiences, as we try and inspire others to enjoy Plain Success on the Plain Success podcast. We'll include contact information for you, how people can reach out to you in the show notes. Adam, thanks again. It's been awesome.
Thank you so much, Alan. I really appreciate you having me on. It was a great time.
My dad used to tell me, Alan, remember the little things. Remembering the little things is the key to plain success. The key to a life motivated by hope, filled with happiness, blessed with prosperity, and powered by purpose. If there was at least one little thing in this episode that uplifted, inspired, or motivated you, will you do a little thing for me? Share this episode with someone else. Until next time, remember the little things.